Investors Chronicle.
Back to the Companies and Market Show. It is Thursday, the 19th of January, 2023. As we record, delighted to welcome back Michael Fahey. Hi, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you?
Very well. Good to have you here. We've got James Norrington on in a little bit as well. He's not quite here yet, but he will be. He's standing ready. And Dan Jones hosting as normal. Dan, what are we talking about today?
Hi, John. We are going to start today with a look at the big builders and why they might be in a little bit of a better place than some people think. Then we're going to talk about our cover story this week, which is all about identifying income stocks. James will be here, as mentioned, to talk us through that. And finally, we are looking at Kinetic, one of the many trading updates out in the past few days. We are going to delve into its figures in a bit more detail and discuss defence in general.
Flavour of the IC's companies coverage this week. Oil and gas companies have committed to investing in North Sea oil exploration. The North Sea Transition Authority, which hands out UK offshore oil and gas permits, said its latest funding round matched the previous one from 2019. It comes despite fears the energy windfall tax might dampen investment enthusiasm. Alex Hamer has the full write-up online. Payments company Wise has increased its full-year guidance, now forecasting total income growth to be around the 70% mark. It comes after rising interest rates boosted the company. Arthur Sands with the write-up of that one. Ocado's sales have fallen for the very first time. The online grocery retailer, now with ties to M&S, saw revenue drop 4% for the 2022 financial year. Despite a forewarning to investors, shares fell 6% on the news. Publisher Pearson, on the other hand, said it traded ahead of expectations in 2022. The company achieved the best total returns of all FTSE 100 companies last year and brought in an 11% increase in adjusted operating profits for the year. Couple of food delivery company updates. Firstly, Just Eat takeaway shares rose 15% after a fourth quarter update outlining a, quote, material improvement in profits. Annual order numbers were, however, down 9% for 2022 as consumers cut back on spending to end the year. Meanwhile, Deliveroo also said it expected to be more profitable than previously forecast, citing profit margin expansion and cost control as the reasons. And finally, bootmaker Dr. Martens fell 22% this Thursday morning after revealing a £30 million decrease to its full-year profits. The group said it was experiencing operational issues at its new distribution centre in Los Angeles. And Gemma Slingo has a longer write-up of that one too on the IC website and in the magazine.
Let's get on with the show. We start with building contractors. You think that this is not the year for them. The housing market is going to struggle. General building is surely going to suffer if and when a recession emerges. But there are, in fact, some reasons to be cheerful as we interrogate a bit more this week. Mike, you wrote the piece looking at companies like Kier, Costain, Balfour Beatty, Morgan Sindall. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's right. So I started the piece with some data from Glenigan, which is a construction data company that tracks projects generally at the smaller end of the market, so 100 million plus or 100 million or less. And I did that for a reason, and that was because in many cases that's where these a lot of the housing work, a lot of the smaller scale infrastructure work around new housing estates, etc., that's where a lot of that will lie. And when you look at that part of the market, it does look quite grim. I think the workloads are due to fall. There are fewer projects in the pipeline. The house builders themselves seem to slow down new starts at the end of last year because of fears about the overall level of demand and the amount of people looking at new sales. But that is, for the market overall, that is going to definitely have a dampening effect. And when you look at things like the Construction Products Association's forecast, it's downgraded its its output forecast for 2023 a few times, and the last one was suggesting that I think a negative 3.1% growth this year. And that's partly, again, the lack of new housing starts, but also fewer people doing conversions at home and DIY because of the cost of living squeeze. But when you look at the listed contractors, and for investors, that's where the interest lies, they are not as reliant on that side of things as they once were. And certainly the likes of Balfour's kind of actively disengaged from the house building or the market for big towers in London, partly because it's so cyclical, really. And construction has always been considered a massively cyclical sector. But the piece looked at the fact that for many of these larger contractors, the infrastructure is going to underpin so much of what they do for the next couple of years. It almost provides a nice floor. It provides them with a steady flow of work, which then allows them to invest in kit, in training, and in lots of other things, you know, modern methods of construction. If you know you have a project that's going to run for several years where an investment, where you know you're going to get a return on an investment, if you invest in a massive piece of machinery, then you're more likely to do it.
Infrastructure, of course, many of our listeners may have access to this theme via Infrastructure Investment Trusts, which if they do, they'll know they've done very well over a number of years now. I mean, is infrastructure, you know, itself as an asset class, as an opportunity, recession resistant? You know, does it have the ability to hold up in difficult times like this, you know, which we might be going through?
Yeah, I think hold up is quite difficult, isn't it? Because infrastructure is often seen as somewhere where people might take shelter in a recession, but then there's when you look at the higher borrowing rates and higher rates of return, then the returns that infrastructure investments offer don't look quite as good. I suppose it's safety, isn't it? There are going to be re-ratings on some of the projects that those trusts ultimately hold, and maybe downwards, but over a 30-year lifespan, it shouldn't make a huge difference.
Yeah, and some of the things you touched on in the piece, some if not bullet points, then certainly reasons to be relatively cheerful. For example, in the autumn statement, you know, there wasn't a sort of mass cancellation of projects
no.
that some had feared. Obviously, these are the very, very big ticket projects like HS2, things like that, but that's a promising sign nonetheless.
Yeah, and when we were talking about infrastructure trust, generally we're talking about things that hold assets that are already built, whereas with the contractors, they're looking at active workloads, they're looking at, and also they're looking at quite a lot of projects where the government is ultimately footing the bill, and there will still be state assets at the end of the day, whether that's the rail lines, the Great Core Northern Powerhouse Rail Project and HS2, and it's schemes like that are really keeping some of the contractors, the likes of Balfour Beatty and Keir, really busy.
And even, the office market, which is going through some obvious difficulties, not least as the continued shift towards hybrid working continues to play out. Even there are some positives in terms of refits, refurbs, which is a subject our property correspondent Mitchell has written about a few times. But that could be a bit of a boon as well.
Yeah, so I think the problem with new build work in offices at the moment is that generally if you are going to develop a massive new office block speculatively, and there aren't many doing that, there are some, but there aren't many, you need a pre-let, you need an anchor tenant who's going to take maybe 20% of the space. And at the minute, while companies are still working out what they want to do with their office space and how much they need and whether they are going to shift from one to, you know, from two buildings to one or five to two, there's probably not that many or not as many active commitments as there were. But there are opportunities with refurbs, especially hybrid working. And when I last spoke to Morgan Sindall, which admittedly was early last year, John Morgan was kind of very bullish on this area, on the fact that they were really busy with office fit-outs as people were repurposing space, putting in more auditorium space and like groups working spaces where people can come together when they come into the office.
And there's also an ESG impulse in some cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the kind of one of the biggest problems with construction and construction of new buildings is the kind of carbon footprint. And if you, by refurbishing, then clearly you're not pumping lots of concrete, which uses so much energy really to generate.
Let's finish by talking a little bit about valuation. For one thing, some of these companies look relatively cheap, but that's probably a reflection of the economic outlook. You know, you've got to take these things in context. Another aspect of it is that maybe the mid-tier operators look a bit more vulnerable than the bigger players, which is often the case, again, in times of stress.
So in terms of the big contracting groups that we focused on in this article, they do look cheap, other than, well, Balfour Beatty is the one that's maybe priced slightly more, on a slightly higher multiple, and even that's only like 11 times earnings. There are reasons for that. I think one is that Balfour has some other strings to its bow. Its support services arm, which does a lot of power and rail maintenance, has much higher margins. I think it generated something like 50% of last year's profit, even though it was only between 10 and 15% of the total turnover. So it has that. The contractors are generally pretty lowly rated because the margins are so low. You know, they're working off 1% and 2% off some of these big projects. And another reason why they're so lowly rated is because when you're working on margins that are that fine, it doesn't take a lot to go wrong before you have complete wipeouts. And most of them, especially in the wake of a couple of years ago when Carillion was going bust and Interserve was going through its own restructuring, there were a lot that then found problem contracts. And I think, again, one of the reasons why Balfour's maybe slightly higher rated is it's had those wipeouts as well, where it's had a couple of years of losses, but it's not had them for a long time. I know Julian talked about Leo Quinn and the CEO and his role as a turnaround expert. And I think Leo came in 2015, and it's not had an unprofitable year since 2015, although its margins are still pretty fairly weak. I think last year it was 1.2%.
Yeah, and the other thing we should say on that front, I suppose, is other than Morgan Sindall, you know, share price performance has been a little bit underwhelming, even for the bigger players.
Yeah, Kieran Costain have been awful, really, if you've invested in those. I think both have lost about 80% or more. Costain is something that I wrote about in the idea section, because I think there's definitely a potential for a re-rating there. We point out in the piece again that its last cash balance was around 96 million and it's valued at just over 100 million. So if you're just taking the cash on its balance sheet and subtract that, the business has got to be worth more than 10 million, you'd think, for something with its expertise. The problem, again, is that it's had those profit wipeouts in past years and it just needs to develop a track record of not spectacular profits, but steady, profitable growth.
Just showing it can do what it's supposed to do. Yeah, well, that piece, as we say, is in the print issue this week and it is online, so do take a look at that. Thanks, Mike. We'll come back to you in a bit, but for now we're going to refer to our cover story this week, which, as discussed, is on dividends, income-paying stocks. Again, might be a place to hide in difficult times. Certainly something that a large section of the population relies on in the latter years for income streams nowadays. James, you wrote the piece, though, very much looking at how you can identify a reliable dividend payer, if possible, particularly at a time where, you know, again, the backdrop has changed, interest rates are higher than they were. Why don't you sort of talk us through your initial thinking?
Hi, Dan. Hi, Mike. The thinking behind the piece really was, you know, the dividend cover for FTSE 100. It's a bit of research out before Christmas by AJ Bell. Suggested that that was pretty good, you know, expecting it to sort of to be a healthy two times for the FTSE 100 anyway next year. But that sort of belies a few other factors. There's one, obviously the FTSE 100 is quite a concentrated index, first of all. So if you get sort of the energy majors have a bumper year, some of the banks doing a bit better with income, net interest income with rising rates, then that sort of distorts matters a bit. But also, you know, we're at sort of a bit of an inflection point with company earnings and what you can expect with company earnings. There's probably a lot of potential to disappoint next year, which means that that cover in 12 months' time may not have been as rosy as that picture with there could be a lot of re-ratings in the market. So really, it was looking at some of the factors you should look at with a long-term dependable dividend stock. It's pretty consistent what you'd always look for from a dividend stock. You want a company with reliable cash flows, a good rate of growth. You kind of tend to want to avoid the companies with very high dividend yield. I mean, that's the obvious thing, because that's normally a sign of something wrong. The sense checks you look at, obviously, dividend cover, but it's not just, as we mentioned, dividend cover by earnings. You also want to look at the quality of those earnings and the sustainability of those earnings now a bit more. You're also looking at what are the competing calls on cash that a company has as well. So debt repayments, so you want to look at the interest cover, how much operating profits can cover that interest obligation. What you also want to look at is capital expenditure. That's obviously going to be a competitor for cash in a business, but you need to look at things in terms of trend, because a company finding something good to invest in that's going to generate you more profits over the long term, that's not a bad thing, and that isn't necessarily running against the interests of people who want investment for income. If the company remains liquid and solvent, then that's probably a good thing for the long run. Where you want to be a bit more vigilant is in terms of the replacement capex cycle. You could expect to see a dip if companies have a regular need to replace in terms of their free cash flow, but you would be a little bit more concerned if they went negative on replacement capex. But a dip would be something that you'd probably expect to see. And then you're going into looking at sort of some of the idiosyncrasies of how companies manage their inventory, how they account for things like sort of creative things are they doing on their tax statement versus their tax expense. Because all these things they feed through to what earnings are being reported, and you want to compare that to that earnings per share to your dividend per share when you're looking at your cover, and then obviously always in the background you're looking at the cash situation, the cash flows, the conversion of operating income into operating cash flows as well.
Well, one thing you look at is, as you expect, you know, the question of what to pay for income versus what you get. I mean, the dividend yield is perhaps an interesting point to pick up on, just because with a higher risk-free rate, you do, you know, require potentially a higher dividend yield, but equally you go too high and there are red flags there. So one thing you do look at in the piece, as I say, is how to structure the question of what you want to pay for a good income stock. And you do that by looking at the Gordon growth model.
I bring in the Gordon growth model. I mean, which is basically sort of a perpetual way of valuing a dividend paying stock. So it's quite a useful way of looking at sort of, say, utilities that have grown. I use the example of I use National Grid, I think, in my piece, and it's a way of looking at the constant growth of the stock, a constant growth rate, which you could look at historical dividend growth rate, but the way I've done it is look at return on equity and the retention rate of earnings to look at long term growth. And use that to value a perpetual rate, subtracting a risk-free rate, which I've used the 10-year UK gilt yield for at the moment, or gross redemption yield, is about 3.5%. That would suggest, looking at that now, and this sort of speaks to some of the interest here, that actually National Grid, for example, was a bit undervalued. But that's not really the case. I think it's the investors in shares are adding in another premium. Possibly they're a bit more sceptical about inflation. I mean, I think the required rate of return, looking at my Gordon model, would be about 5%, but according to the share price, it's about 7%. So, I mean, I don't think the market's necessarily wrong, but the interesting thing is the timing of when you're an income investor, of you know, when you're expecting stocks to do the heavy lifting. I mean, if inflation prints come in a bit better than expected over the next year or so, then actually you could say a stock like that is probably undervalued now, and it will go up, and it definitely will, because people's discount rates will change. Mm. But in sort of the shorter term, even though long-term gilt yields, you know, they do factor in inflation, but they're also sort of factoring in second guessing what central banks are going to do with rates. So that they're not necessarily the actual premium that people require for inflation of an equity investor. They add that in themselves. We have a sort of a pretty informationally efficient market at the large cap level. So, but it is still interesting to look at the discrepancies between, a model, a theoretical model like the Gordon model, and how the market is currently valuing stocks.
Yeah, there are obviously always external factors to take into account and be aware of. Let's finish on, very simplistic question or point. But, one of the things the piece also does is it looks at one of the Investors Chronicle Alpha screens, the dividend compounder screen, and it just gives some example of the kind of stocks that, do relatively well on that basis. And they are, in the main, the mega cap kind of companies. Is bigger better right now? For a variety of reasons, not automatically, of course, or is it, is that just a function of the screen in this case?
It's easier to look at and illustrate the flags with the alpha screens. We look at mid cap and small cap and AIM as well. I mean, a small cap screens, dividends more of a value indicator at that level. Mid cap, I think you could probably find some good dividend paying stocks further down the cap scale if you looked at some of the measures we looked in the feature. But the large cap, really, because you can see because we had to relax the screen because of the COVID, so there's a few stocks in there that probably you wouldn't get in if we'd had a normal past 5 years, whatever a normal past 5 years is. So it's easier to really illustrate the flag. So a screen like that's most useful to look in the column on the right if you pick up the magazine and look at the flags of what's been failed, and then actually almost read it backwards and look at those to see whether these companies should be in your income portfolio.
Start from the point of view of what they're doing worst, and then work your way up. Yeah, as you say, James, all that information is in the magazine this week and online. There's a lot of data in there, a lot of food for thought, so do pick that up if you get the chance. But we're going to conclude today with a company-specific trading update. Defence has clearly been of greater interest to investors over the past year since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It hasn't always panned out perfectly in terms of share price gains, but Kinetic has been one of the good performers. That said, there were signs of slowing momentum in the order book in this Q3 update. Is that just a blip?
Yeah, so just to take a step back for anyone who's not familiar with the company, it's very much at the cutting edge science and technology end of defence. It was a spin out from a research arm of the Ministry of Defence way back when, before it was floated on the stock exchange. A lot of the things that it does are things like autonomous vehicles, some of the drone technologies, a lot of work in cyber. And that has, I think, a bit of an impact on the way in which its valuation is being reflected. We'll come to that later. But in terms of the trading update itself, this time around, you're right, there's evidence of a slowdown in terms of order intake. They flagged order intake of £1 billion, which is decent, but 800 million of that was in the first half. So over the last quarter, they've taken in 200 million, which is a bit of a slowdown. And I think that is maybe the reason why there was probably quite a muted reaction on the markets to the trading up statement, because in general it's still fairly positive. It's going in the right direction. The billion order intake is 10% up on last year. Revenue seems to be running around the same level as last year, but they're still guiding for a decent level of underlying profits of about 11-12% margin.
As we say, defense stocks haven't always panned out amazingly for investors over the past year, despite what you may have expected with the outbreak of the war. What's the reasons for that? And can we talk through a bit of the differences between some?
Yeah, sure, of course. We included a chart which had six of the UK listed defence companies, and two were big outperformers, and Kinetic was one of those two. Two were fairly flat, and two actually had a negative return, which you really wouldn't expect in a year where European governments are massively increasing their commitment to defence spending. And there are stock-specific reasons for the two which were underperformers. One is Avon, which is going through all kinds of issues with its body armour unit, which is winding down. The other is Babcock, which is a big, sizable company in this market, but it's had a couple of years of terrible results and has quite a heavily indebted balance sheet, which it is trying to solve. It's sold off a lot of businesses over the past year, which improves the balance sheet, but doesn't do any much for your revenue or your growth. Of the two that have massively outperformed, one is BAE Systems, and Kinetic is the other. And the two of those have outperformed because I think there's more immediate evidence of the benefits of this increased spending. Generally, government spending on defence contracts, it could take years from a government increasing its budget until that then feeds through in terms of new tank programmes or new destroyers or whatever it is. It takes an awfully long time for these things to go through procurement. But with BAE Systems, it has provided quite a lot of the ammunition to the MOD, which has then provided it to the Ukrainians. And now the UK has agreed to provide Challenger 2 tanks, their BAE Systems made. So it has had quite an immediate benefit from the war in Ukraine. And similarly, Kinetic has much more things that it can turn around in the short term. So one of the things it highlighted this week was an 80 million contract win from the MOD for mission data, a mission data program where it's looked to kind of accelerate the way in which mission data, or more mission data, can be used more quickly and more thoroughly, and the way in which it's shared, and to ensure there's no big cyber threat around that.
Another interesting thing was on, when you look Europe-wide, the biggest gains, just in terms of share prices over the past year, have been a couple of German companies, which also perhaps reflects the fact that while defence is, you know, perennial big business in the UK and the US, it's Germany that's really sort of rethought what's going on. Now, Kinetic doesn't really have much exposure there, but that's perhaps something to keep in mind as well when people are looking at this sector, if they're interested in it.
So it has taken this decision to move to gear more towards the UK, US and Australia, which makes sense in strategic terms, but maybe the way in which the war in the Ukraine has changed the commitments means it could potentially miss out. I mean, Germany was possibly a laggard, or was definitely a laggard, in terms of its commitment to spending 2% of GDP on defence budgets. But it was, as soon as the invasion happened, it made it very clear that it would be doing so from now on. So that's where probably the biggest uplift in European defence spending is going to come in the German market, and hence why two of the major outperformers have been Rheinmetall, a German company that makes tanks, and Hensoldt, which makes threat detection equipment.
And just to return to the UK peer group to conclude, you know, relative valuations there, as we said, there has been that discrepancy over the past year. Does that change the equation looking further ahead as well?
Well, I think one of the strange things really is that you would think with Kinetic, with its technology background, with the fact that it's doing quite a lot of advanced stuff, it would also won a contract for this directional laser weapon. It's kind of very early stage stuff with Australia, a directed energy weapon development contract it was.
Say no more. We all know.
Yeah, indeed.
We all know what that means.
We've all seen the James Bond film, Die Another Day. But it's actually has a slightly lower rating. It's trading on about, less than 13 times earnings. And when you look at its peer group, the likes of BAE, Chemring and Cohalt are all on 14 times. Avon's on 29 times, which is probably a reflection of its earnings weakness rather than any kind of great bullish investor case there. So perhaps an opportunity, really. It's below its own 5-year average, and it's below a lot of its peer group. And given the market for defence spending, certainly shows no sign of weakness. It certainly seems to be going only one way at the minute. Then the long-term prospects for it look pretty good.
Mike, thank you. That does bring us to the end of the show this week. So thanks to James and to Mike and to John. And thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.